Music to get you going in the gardening mode. I kind of like that. What do you think? Let me know if you like that music. Larry Mueller here. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Trying to get you going, get you in the mind of spring here as we visit with Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison. He's in the Department of Plant Pathology as well. And we'll talk about a lot of things in the garden. We can certainly, well, I know we'll address damping off, vegetable diseases, last-minute garden cleanup, and a whole lot more. And if you have questions or comments, maybe you had problems with damping off. Maybe you don't even know what the heck I'm talking about. Well, all right, we'll find out about that as we visit with Brian. Give a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Brian, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. Glad to be here.
Damping off, it sounds terrible.
What is it? When I was asked by your producer what we might talk about today, I thought, well, what have I written recently? I'm starting to do web articles on my clinic website, and the one I just wrote for, I think it was for March, was on damping off. So that's, people love to grow plants from seed indoors, and oftentimes they have problems with the seeds germinating. The plants come up, and then they kind of fall over onto the soil and dry up and die, and that's basically damping off. And we have a lot of problems with it because a lot of folks, when they're starting seed, they tend to do it in their basement, which is a little cooler, and oftentimes they tend to overwater. Not a problem in my household, but for a lot of folks, they really worry about the plants not getting enough water, so they overdo it a little bit, and if you happen to have certain fungi that are around that can cause infections, you get this damping off phenomenon.
Yeah, and so we need to watch the warmer
temperatures to get the seeds germinated quickly. And actually, this particular disease really only attacks the seedlings when they're relatively small. So if you can get them to grow large enough, they basically become immune to the problem. And so there are these heating pads that you can get that will heat up your pots as you're germinating seeds, and those can be very useful. Also, moderating the water. You certainly want to give the seedlings enough to keep them alive, but don't overdo it. Keep it a little bit on the dry side. And then having good cleanup. If you've had any indications of damping off in the past, my recommendation is decontaminate surfaces. You can use something like 10% bleach. Be very careful when you're using that. If you've got plastic pots that you're using or flats and have had damping off or root rot problems in the past, those I recommend discarding. Otherwise, clay pots, ceramic pots, you can decontaminate those as well. 10% bleach as a soak for about 20 to 30 minutes and then rinse them to remove the bleach residues.
What about, so I think that kind of takes care of damping off, although there's a whole lot more we could frankly talk about,
sure.
I guess, relating to it. But just I wanted to get in the part about spring cleanup.
Sure, sure. If you're like me and you get lazy in the fall and don't want to do what we call fall cleanup, then the thing you need to do is consider doing it early in the spring before your plants have started to germinate. Because from a disease standpoint, a lot of the disease-causing organisms that you had in your garden last year are surviving in that old plant material. And so you want to remove it from your yard so you don't have a source of the pathogen to reinfect your plants as they begin to sprout.
Yeah. Can you set it aside and let it sort of heat up and...
A lot of it depends on exactly which disease that you're dealing with, but if it's been things like powdery mildews or some of the common leaf diseases that you see, composting that material, if you do it properly, is fine. If you do what I do, which is kind of have a pile of stuff in the back corner of the yard, that's not adequate. That actually is a ready source of spores that can reinfect plants. But if you're a good composter and get that compost pile to a high temperature, 140 degrees Fahrenheit or hotter, and routinely turn it, that combination of the temperature, high temperature, and also the rotting that you get from continually turning material, that tends to eliminate a lot of disease-causing organisms.
We had some warm weather, and then it got cold,
yeah.
And sort of it could have killed or probably not killed some of those early spring flowering.
I'm worried a little bit.
Yeah.
We saw some situations where buds were beginning to swell, and if they went too far and then it got really cold thereafter, then we're worried about some branch dieback on broadleaf trees and shrubs. The other thing that I worry a lot about are on conifers, particularly things like yews.
Yeah.
They'll come out of the winter and then they'll turn brown, something called winter burn. And if they don't have enough internally stored water as they're coming out of dormancy, they'll start to photosynthesize and lose moisture through the needles, but the roots aren't warm enough to take up adequate water. And so those needles will begin to brown.
Well, you mentioned trees and shrubs, and Molly in Janesville has something relating to a tree, I believe. Molly, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, so we have a cedar tree in our yard, and we have just under an acre. And we also have about 10 apple trees, and there's something strange happening to our cedar tree. It's been happening since we've owned the property, but it gets these strange, they almost look like walnuts. And then they sprout tentacles, and the tentacles get slimy, and they all fall to the ground. And I don't remember what it's called. It sounds like something out of a horror movie. But,
yeah.
It has something to do with apples. I've heard it's bad for apple trees, so I didn't know, first of all, what it's called, and secondly, if there's something I can treat it or if we'll need to cut
sure.
the cedar tree down.
What a combination. A cedar tree and a bunch of apple trees right next to each other.
Yeah, very, very good combination from my perspective as a plant pathologist. But luckily, it's a relatively cosmetic disease that you're dealing with. And I'm assuming the cedar that you're talking about is a red cedar, which is a prickly. It's technically a juniper. If it's the softer needled white cedar, then you don't have to worry about this disease. But there is a disease called, well, the technical name for them is Gymnosporangium rust, because Gymnosporangium is the genus of the fungus that causes these diseases.
Better known as cedar apple rust.
Yeah, that's kind of the generic. Yeah, there's a cedar apple rust, there's a hawthorn apple, or excuse me, a cedar hawthorn rust and a cedar quince rust, which are all common here in the state. And they're rust diseases, they're fungal in nature. And what's really cool about them, again, from my perspective, is that the fungus, in order to complete its life cycle, needs to spend part of its time on your red cedar or other types of junipers, and part of its life cycle on either things like apple or crabapple or hawthorn or quince. And you get to see these incredibly ornate and very colorful orange marmalade blobs on your cedar trees, usually starting, I think, in this area, in the Madison area, around maybe mid-May through early June. And you will see at this time of the year, those little walnut-like structures that you mentioned, those are a gall, a swelling of tissue that lets you know that the fungus is still there. And those can be pruned out if you want to do that. Just prune down about 4 inches to 6 inches below where you see that gall. I do recommend decontaminating tools between cuts. I would use something like 70% alcohol. So dip in rubbing alcohol for about 30 seconds. Or if you want to use one of the spray disinfectants, you can do that. Spray until the tools drip and then allow them to air dry. And that's an easy way to get rid of the fungus on the juniper host or the red cedar host.
Sure, yeah. Up. It's probably 15 feet, so I don't know how practical it would be to.
Yeah, and that can be an issue. What you'll see on the apples, the other host, if it's cedar apple or cedar hawthorn rust, usually what you'll see are these very bright yellow or orange spots on the leaves. Occasionally you'll see fruit infections, but I don't see those that commonly. And then eventually what you'll see are these little tentacles that will form underneath the leaf surfaces where there are these yellow spots. And those are the structures that are producing spores that reinfect the junipers. And those orange masses that you see, those are producing the spores that are infecting your apple trees. The other variant that's really freaky to a lot of people is the cedar quince rust oftentimes has a preference for infecting the fruits on hawthorn trees. So if you get these really salmony colored spiny fruits, that's another variant to this particular disease. And quite frankly, it's very cosmetic. The main control is either to prune off those galls if you have the two hosts close together. If you're planting a landscape, usually I recommend not planting both of the hosts close to one another, and I would separate them by at least probably about 100 feet or more just to be safe. But the bottom line is it's very cosmetic. It usually doesn't cause much significant damage at all. It's just very colorful, so you notice it.
It is indeed.
Which is nice for me, because most of what I see is brown and black and rotting and slimy and disgusting. So this is a pretty disease from my perspective.
There you go,
yeah,
Molly.
My daughter thinks it's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Keep it at that, maybe.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling.
And I just did a little video for the, what is it called, Blue Sky Science, I think it is. It's run through the Morgridge Foundation, yeah. And yeah. They had somebody that sent in a leaf that had a spot on it. We did a little segment on that. And we do have a fact sheet on this disease on my website. So if you go to pddc.wisc.edu, that's my clinic website, and you can find a fact sheet in our fact sheet section.
There we go. Thanks again, Molly. You can join in, too, by the way. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Let's go to John in Eau Claire next. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. I am trying to start a raspberry bed, and I don't know what species to get. I would like to get something that's disease-resistant. I don't know a difference between, like, everbearing and fall-bearing, and when I ask a nursery, they usually just recommend the species that they have on sale.
Yeah.
So I don't know what species to get, and I was hoping you could help.
I don't see a ton of problems on raspberries. They're pretty – we do see diseases occasionally, some powdery mildew, sometimes a little bit of rust. But for the most part, from a disease standpoint, I don't see them as being particularly problematic. Where you're more going to run into problems are with insect pests. There's a new insect called the spotted-winged Drosophila that's arrived in the state, and that one is very much a problem on raspberries, particularly – those that bear later in the season. So if you're going to go for a variety, I would go for one that fruits relatively early. And even then, we don't know exactly long-term how this insect is going to adapt to the state. So eventually those may be a problem as well. But at this point, it's more late-bearing raspberries that have been a problem than early-bearing raspberries.
Okay. And then the early raspberries, do they still bear throughout the whole season? Or is it just only in the spring and then they're done?
I think some of them are only in the spring and done, and then they're the ever-bearing that will bear throughout the season. They'll go all year. So you might be able to get with the ever-bearing, you might be able to get an early crop, but again, I suspect that you will eventually see this little insect, and they lay their eggs in the fruits, and they're unusual compared to other sorts of fruit flies because they will go after healthy fruit, and the females lay eggs, and then you'll see these little white larvae that will eventually form in the fruit. And so you can pick the fruit and they'll look perfectly fine, set them on your countertop, and then all of a sudden there are these little white larvae that are wiggling around. And I had someone call me who was very, very upset. They'd gone to a pick-your-own place and apparently had gotten some of this, and they had made a non-cooked jam and set it out on their countertop and came down in the middle of the night. And apparently, I don't think it was from the insects, but I think the insects had brought in yeasts and other sort of organisms that produced a lot of gas. So it had popped the tops off of the jars, and she apparently had jam all over the walls and the cabinetry in her kitchen. So you definitely want to watch out for that insect. It's called spotted winged Drosophila. And again, if you go to my clinic website, to the fact sheet section, we have a fact sheet on that insect. You can read more about it.
All right.
Okay. Are they also affecting blackberries?
They will go to blackberries as well, yes. That's my understanding.
Yep.
Oh. Okay.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We'll have to bring that up again when we talk with our insect guys.
Yeah, definitely. If Phil or PJ is on, and those would be some folks. Or if you, I don't know if you had Christelle Godot on, who is our fruit entomologist.
I have not.
No, she would be a great guest for you, I think. She's really great. So, and she's the person who wrote the fact sheet on spotted ring Drosophila.
Chris in Waterloo, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
We're talking about apple cedar rust.
Mm-hmm.
This can occur also on juniper trees, you said?
Yes, it alternates back and forth between those two hosts.
Okay. My question is, can this infect cherry trees?
No.
It doesn't?
No. What are you seeing on your cherry?
On the cherry itself, I see a black spot.
On the branches or on the fruits?
On the fruit.
On the fruits. Does it eventually get kind of a buff colored fuzzy material, and do they kind of mummify out over the
yes,
over time?
Actually, yes, they do.
Yeah, then it's probably a disease called brown rot that's common to what we call stone fruits, which would it's any of those fruits that have a pit inside, so cherries, plums, peaches, and that's a very, very common disease. It's fungal again,
okay. And
that one will infect the fruits. It can also sometimes infect the branch tips, so to manage that one, you need to scour the ground around the base of the tree and look for any of those fruits that have dropped to the ground, because that's where the fungus will overwinter.
Oh, okay.
And then also watch for any of the branch tips that have died. And again, prune those back about 4 to 6 inches.
Uh-huh.
And then those I would burn or bury.
Uh-huh.
And I would not bury the fruits, but you could probably get away with burning the or burying the branches. But better way is just to get it in your garbage and throw it out that way, or take it to your local yard waste place and drop it off there for them to compost.
Okay. Well,
and then you might have to do some fungicide treatments if it's really bad, but sometimes you can get enough control just by scouring and getting rid of all this infected material that you'll bring in under check. We've seen a lot of this the last probably 2 or 3 years. We've seen a peak in this disease.
Yeah. And the tree is only about 4 years old.
Yeah, it can affect any age tree, quite frankly. It tends to be, it likes to get in through wounds. So if you have a lot of insect activity that feed on the fruit, sometimes the fungus will get in that way. Sometimes you'll see an increase after hail.
Okay.
So it's a very common disease. And again, we have a fact sheet on this if you're interested in reading more about it.
All
okay,
right.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Brian Huddleston, our guest, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison from the Department of Plant Pathology. I'm Larry Mueller here for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Next week on Garden Talk, Liz Freemuth, the Garden Ho, returns to talk about spring gardening. So I hope you can join us for that. Right now, Brian Huddleston visiting with us about spring cleanup and diseases and damping off and all kinds of other things. So I hope you'll join in with your questions. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Marianne and Fall Creek up next. Hi, Marianne.
Hi. I have a question about fertilizing. When I started fertilizing my indoor plants with Epsom salt, and it worked out pretty good, so I moved the Epsom salt outside. I have probably 100 different pastas. And what I first did, I dissolved the Epsom salt in water and hauled it from plant to plant. But that got too much work, so I just took the Epsom salt and threw it over the ground. And when it rained, it soaked in the ground. So I was wondering if I do anything to the birds or to the wildlife. I mean, the Epsom salt is good for my plants. I mean, but I was wondering if that is really a good thing to do in the long run.
Yeah, the Epsom salt is basically magnesium sulfate. So certainly plants need magnesium. That's actually the molecule that sits element that's at the center of a chlorophyll molecule. So definitely plants can use that. It's not going to take care of all of your fertility issues. My main concern with throwing it over the top of the plant would be if it's at high enough concentration and if it doesn't dissolve right away and go into the soil, you might get some burn symptoms from that.
Yeah.
So that would be a caution. In terms of wildlife issues, I don't know of anything, but I'm not actually the person to answer that particular question. That should go to one of our wildlife folks. So what I would suggest that you do, why don't you give me a call or email me. I'll give out some information. My phone number is 608-262-2863, or you can email me at Huddleston, HUDELSON, at WISC.edu. And then I can hook you up directly with one of our wildlife folks. I won't give the information over the air just because I don't know whether they would like me to do that or not, but I'm happy to give it off to individuals if you give me a call or send me an email.
Lexi's probably got that up on our Facebook page, that contact information.
Yeah, and if you go to my website as well, the contact information is there as well. It may be a slightly different email. They keep changing my emails, but they all work. I have about 5 of them, so... you can email me at any of those.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling, Marianne. Jeff in Madison has something for us now. Jeff, hello.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. We have a problem with zinnias.
Mm-hmm.
We've been planting state fair variety zinnias in a particular spot, and it's just been a marvelous stand of zinnia color, and they're very resistant to powdery mildew. But last year, the leaves started to curl and the blooms started to discolor a little bit. And my wife found out that there's a soil-borne disease of some sort. And the only remedy is to not plant zinnias for at least 3 years in that same location.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was wondering if there... if there's a recommended plant to use, you know, during that 3-year period that will help improve the soil so that we could put zinnias back again.
Yeah, in general, it's not a good idea to grow the same plant in the same spot year after year after mm-hmm. year. So I would basically not do that for any type of annual that you're planting. So move them around in your garden from year to year. Now, when you said that the leaves were curling up, were they rigid or did they look wilted? Or what was the characteristic of those leaves?
They would curl and they were brown on the edges.
Brown on the edges. Okay. And you said the flowers looked a little bit lighter in color, a little bleached?
Actually, they were getting some dark spots on them.
Okay, that could be a different sort of problem. The marginal browning, that sort of thing, could be due to a root rot pathogen. Those will infect the root system and destroy some of the roots, and that'll interfere with water uptake. With those, you might have to be a little careful what else you plant in the spot, because some of those pathogens have a relatively broad host range. So what you can do is either cut back a little bit on watering or improve water drainage by adding a little bit of organic material to the soil. That'll sometimes help with control of those particular organisms. On the other hand, it could be if you weren't watering enough, you can also get marginal browning from that. That can be a water stress symptom. The curling is what's making me wonder a little bit. Do you use any sort of lawn fertilizers at all? And are these plants near the lawn in your yard?
No, we stay away from the lawn fertilizers.
Okay. Well,
we will amend each spring from a composter.
Okay.
But that's, other than that, and watering it.
Okay.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah, the reason I was asking about the lawn materials is because if you do have a lawn service or use some of the weed and feeds, there are herbicides in those, and if those drift, that can lead to curling of leaves. Mm. So, but in general, I would say go ahead and move your zinnias to another spot, put something in that location, try to modify the soil probably to improve the drainage just a little bit, and then be cautious with your watering that you don't overwater. And how are you watering? Use a sprinkler or a hose? How do you water your plants?
Hose.
Okay, that's good. Drip hoses or soaker hoses are what we recommend to get that moisture right into the soil.
Yeah, now we do a hose and we do it right at the soil level to stay away from the plant.
Leaves and the flowers. Yep. The other thing, those little spots that you're seeing on the flowers could be a disease called gray mold. That's a fungal disease, and that fungus really likes to infect flowers. The petals are a little bit wimpier than leaf tissue, and that fungus is a bit of a wimpy pathogen, and it will get into the petals. If you want to read more about that, we do have a fact sheet on that, again, at my website. The disease is called gray mold or botrytis blight, but it should be under gray mold. That one is difficult. If you want those perfect flowers, what you're really left with that one is fungicide treatments, because you're doing everything else right, which is not getting water on the flowers. So if you're having a serious problem with that particular disease, you might have to use a fungicide treatment if you really want to get it under control. And I don't normally recommend those for home gardeners. Sometimes it's better just to live with a few spots on the petals.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call, Jeff. And we'll turn to Bruce next in Madison. Bruce, hi, thank you for calling.
Hey, hello there. Hey, thanks. Great show. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Got a question about a plum tree. It's like it's a Stanley, like an Italian prune plum.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about 20 years old, and it's got these, they're not, the bark like peels away in various places on the big limbs and just exposes the wood.
Okay.
It's not like the bark is like falling off.
Okay.
But it's like this wound with a very clean bark edge around it.
Okay.
Is that something coming in through the roots? Is that terminal? Is it just an old tree? What's going on there?
Yeah. So there's no new bark forming underneath where you're seeing the old bark come off. Is that correct?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And do you happen to see any large blobs of sap associated with those openings in the
once
branches?
In a while, yes, occasionally, yes. Well,
yeah, then you're probably dealing with a bacterial disease called bacterial canker, and that one's very difficult to manage. Is this only in side branches, or is it in the main trunk?
Well, there might be one on the main trunk and then some up on the upper branches.
Yeah, there's not much you can do for this disease if it's on the main trunk. If it's on an isolated branch, you can prune it out, but you need to prune back about 10 to 12 inches below where you see any indication of that gap in the bark or any indication of that those blobs of sap. And then you definitely need to be careful between cuts to decontaminate your tools. And again, 70% alcohol would be what I would suggest, because that bacterium you can pick up very easily on pruning tools. And if you make other cuts, you can inoculate other branches. On the main trunk, there's not anything you can do, because if you talk about pruning, you're talking about removing the tree. What you basically want to do is provide good fertility and good water to the tree so it's growing vigorously to keep it alive as long as you can. But if it is this bacterial disease, I would expect with a trunk infection, eventually you will lose the tree, unfortunately. But you can maintain it for a while, and if it's bearing fruit, keep it around until it stops doing that.
Yeah, gotcha. So is that coming in through the roots, or is that?
No, actually, interestingly, there are a couple of different bacteria that can cause that disease. One of them is actually what's called a natural epiphyte on the plant, so it grows naturally on plant surfaces, including on your cherry and plum trees. You find it almost everywhere on plant surfaces. It's just that it will get in through wounds, or it may get to high population because we have really wet conditions. And then if there's some sort of wound or opening, then it'll get into the branches and start to cause problems.
Yeah, there is a fair amount of fog where this
okay, yeah, and that may just be providing a lot of moisture that's very conducive for this bacterium to grow. And if you got any hail, or even just during routine pruning, you may have introduced the bacterium into the branches.
There you go.
Okay, so just try to keep the tree as healthy as it can. Keep it growing. Don't stress it out.
Reduce any sort of stresses. And again, if you want to read more about this, you can go to my clinic website. We have a fact sheet on this disease as well. It's bacterial canker.
And that website is pddc.wisc.edu.
That's correct.
PDDC for Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic.
That's correct.
All right. There we go.
You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at UWPDDC if you're interested. There are links from the website as well.
There we go. Thanks a lot, Bruce.
Thanks a lot. Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yeah, we've got to plug all these social media anymore, so...
There it is. Bob at Amherst Junction, you're next. Hi, Bob.
Hi, thanks. I think it was the winter of 2013. It was really cold. And I've got a number of apple trees where the bark actually was killed by the frost.
Yes.
And then a black, powdery...
growth
coating has come in and continues, especially in the crotches of trees.
Mm-hmm.
And some of it's actually shown up in new trees in new places, mm-hmm. even this year.
Okay.
And it kills the outside bark, and the wood is exposed underneath.
Yeah, it's probably not actually killing the bark. It's probably coming in as a consequence of something else causing a problem, and you saw a lot of it, you said, after that really harsh winter of 2013 when there was a lot of cold injury to trees. And these sorts of fungi, my guess would be if you looked at them the branches very closely, that black material is pretty much on the surface. It really doesn't penetrate into the bark. And whenever branches are injured, or sometimes when there are insects like scale insects or aphids that are feeding on a tree, they drop what's called honeydew. It's their feces onto branches or leaves, and then fungi will colonize that. They will colonize old branches that have been damaged, or just old branches that are kind of going on their way out and are kind of leaking nutrients. And there are all of these fungi out in the environment that are just waiting to pounce on these nutrient supplies. And a lot of them produce black-colored spores. And so you may have heard of something called sooty mold. That's kind of a variation on this particular problem. And I do see this quite frequently on apple trees. But again, I don't think the fungus is what's causing the problem. There are other stresses or other factors that are damaging the tree that are just releasing nutrients that these fungi can grow on.
And what is black rot?
Black rot is a type of, is technically a disease, but that's a fruit disease. on apples, and you'll actually see a rot in the fruit. And there is a branch variant of that disease, so it can occur in the branches as well. It'll cause a canker and branch dieback. But that particular organism you would never see. It's actually embedded in the wood and is causing is growing and girdling the branches. So that superficial black stuff that you're seeing, though, is not would not be the black rot organism.
There we go.
And so I'm not spreading that around by pruning or...
Anytime you prune, you really should be decontaminating tools between cuts.
I do, and I use bleach. You've been talking about alcohol.
Yeah.
Alcohol.
Yeah, the reason I mentioned alcohol for metal tools is because if you use bleach routinely, your tools are going to rust. Oh, and
yeah.
So alcohol is a little better option for metal tools. You can certainly use 10% bleach. Although nowadays it's actually 7 to 8% bleach because the concentrate you buy at the grocery store is more concentrated than it used to be. But I still tell folks 10% bleach because it's easier to mix up. It's one part of bleach and then 9 parts of water. You can certainly use that as a dip, but be sure to rinse them well after you're done. And then I would also oil them to help prevent the rusting. So it's a little bit more of a hassle if you use bleach.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Dan in Waukesha next. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Thanks for taking my call. I have four, I think, are Canadian cherry trees.
Mm-hmm.
They're about 25 feet tall. In the spring, the leaves are green, and they turn red in about June.
Okay.
The problem I'm having with those is there's absolutely a hundreds of some type of fungus growing on the branches. And I was just wondering, is there a way I can get rid of that? The trees seem healthy. The leaves seem healthy. But,
yeah. This is a disease that I affectionately call poop on a stick because that's what
that's
it looks
exactly
like.
It.
Yeah. It, the technical name is something called black knot. And it's a swelling of the branches that's induced by a fungal infection. And unfortunately, a lot of the native cherries that we have here in North America are quite susceptible. And so you'll see these on the branches. The main thing is as you've commented, it doesn't cause a lot of damage. So the branches typically don't die. The branches typically leaf out fine. It's just it looks really ugly, particularly in the wintertime. Your option to try to manage it is really pruning. And if you've got as many galls as you're describing, you're talking about severely pruning the tree to the point that it won't have any aesthetic appeal in the landscape. So in your situation, I would be inclined to just try to live with the disease, try to ignore it, because pruning is just not going to be a real good option. If you catch it early in smaller trees, you can prune it out. Again, prune down about 4 to 6 inches below where you see that swollen area. And the unfortunate part is, by the time you see that swollen part of the branch, the infection has been there for 2 years and or two growing seasons. And when the fungus initially infects, it just makes a little bit of roughening on the bark that you might not even notice. But if you could notice those roughened areas and prune those out earlier, you get better control. But it's very, very difficult for most people to notice the disease it's really early.
These trees are 10 years old, they're been overtaken by that. I originally started doing the pruning, but couldn't stay on top of it.
Right.
Too much of it.
And again, then
is
it
that a terminal?
No, it doesn't kill the tree. They'll live with it quite happily. And in fact, if you have trunk infections, as the trees get really big, if you get one of those on a black cherry, you'll get a huge burl.
Yeah.
On the trunk, and those are quite valuable for woodworkers. So there is some value to this disease in certain situations. But from your standpoint, if the tree is no longer of aesthetic appeal in your yard, that would be a situation where we talk about a single basal prune. So remove the tree and get rid of it and replace it with something else. It really depends on how tolerant you are of having trees that don't look exactly the way you'd like them to look.
No, they look nice in the summer.
Okay.
Like you said, in the winter.
Yeah. If you're willing to live with it in the winter and they look fine for you in the summer, I would say just leave it. Don't worry about the pruning. You're not going to get ahead of it anyway. And just kind of live with the disease.
All right.
Excellent. Makes it easier. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling, Dan. And Jennifer in Monona, what's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So we have a strawberry bed that's about like 6 by 12. And I've had it for several years, but I never really know what to do in the spring. So I, as a last-ditch effort, I cover it with leaves from our yard. But I know at this time of year when it's so wet, the leaves and the moisture, the strawberries, you know, are starting to come up for the plants.
Mm-hmm.
What do I do? Do you have any recommendations? What I've done in the past is I'll pull the leaves off. Sometimes I'll put them back on with cold nights, or I'll, like, take a sheet. But is there something that I can kind of cover them, let them grow, yet not have to do that on a daily basis?
What I would suggest doing, there's a really excellent publication that's available through our Learning Store website. That's the UW Extension Publications website. It's learningstore.uwex.edu. And the publication is called Growing Strawberries in Wisconsin. There's a whole series of these books. There's Growing Apples, Growing Pears, Growing Stone Fruits, but there's one on strawberries. And that'll provide you a lot of information on basic bed maintenance for strawberries. And I think that would be very valuable for you to either look at that publication online, or quite frankly, with this series, I think it's worth the $5, $6, $7 to buy the publication, because it's a very thick booklet that has just tons of information on, in this particular case, on strawberries. And so it'll talk about, you know, like I said, maintenance. It'll talk about fertility. It'll talk about planting. It'll talk about disease and insect pests, and at least provide some minimal information on management of those sorts of things. But there's a lot of good cultural information in that publication.
Okay. And you said, sorry, can you repeat the website?
Yep. Learning Store, all one word, learningstore.uwex.edu.
Okay.
And if you can't find it there, if you go to my website and look in the links section, I have a link to that website as well.
Yeah. We have it up on our Facebook page as well.
Yeah, that's an excellent place to go for a lot of resources.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling.
Oh, okay. Yeah, thank you.
Judy in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I had a couple of suggestions for the gentleman who was talking about wanting to start a raspberry patch. Mm-hmm. And the first one you just gave, I was going to suggest he consult the book on, I don't know whether it's growing raspberries in Wisconsin or just growing berries in Wisconsin. But in that book, I know he will learn the difference between the summer bearing and the everbearing. And the everbearing truly isn't everbearing. It bears like once in the summer, early summer, on the canes that were left over from last year. And then it bears once in the fall on the brand new canes. And if he doesn't have to worry about Drosophila, which I don't, he said what county he was in, I don't know, but
he was in Eau Claire. We're having problems pretty much statewide.
Okay,
so.
Well, that's probably going to make his decision for him. But otherwise, the cultivation differences, the practices between the summer bearing and the everbearing, make a huge difference in choice.
Yeah,
because
you've got
summer bearing and everbearing, if you want that first crop, you've got to get the canes through the winter.
Right.
And if you've got bunnies or strong winds, or I don't know about deer, but bunnies and winds will really do a number on your canes. So, but I think that book would be very helpful for him to as he tries to.
Yeah, that's an excellent suggestion. And that whole series they have, like I said, they have them on apples and pears and everything. And that whole series of books is just really, really excellent.
Yeah, I've used it many times.
Yeah.
Well, I wish him luck. I love
Riz. All right. Thanks, Judy.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Yeah.
Bye. Appreciate the call.
That fruit fly, it's just caused real problems. We have a lot of folks who used to grow commercially that are getting out of the business because of that particular
insect. Just can't deal with it.
You can't spray enough to get it under control, and so it's not economically feasible for them to stay in business. So,
Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Lexi Broad, our on-air producer here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You are listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Net. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Brian Huddleston, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison, and an open line or two at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org, or you can post a photo and or question on our Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show. And Jim in Stevens Point has a question for you, Brian, so let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Listening to your show reminded me that at the end of the last two summers, the milkweed plants that I've been able to transplant into my perennial flower gardens seem to kind of wither and droop and die, and I was wondering what that might be and if there's anything I can do prior to late summer to make them grow so the monarchs can use them.
Yeah, that one's a difficult one to diagnose over the radio. What I would suggest would be when you start to see the plants begin to wilt and die back would be to get a plant into my clinic for a formal diagnosis. We do charge for that, but with if it's some sort of root rot problem or something else, we would need to actually see plant tissue and see what is actually growing in the plant in order to diagnose that and provide you with a good recommendation on what to do for control. And the thing of it is, it might be an insect problem. There could be something tunneling in the stem that's causing the problem and causing it to die back. So we have folks that can take a look at that as well. So if you check out my website, again, there's information on how to submit a sample. You're always welcome to give me a call or drop me an email if you need advice on what to send in. But I think the only way we're going to get a good handle on what's going on is to see a plant.
Yeah, and you guys run back and forth in the building. You and
oh, yeah, PJ and I are in the same building, so we're always accusing each other that we have somebody else's samples. So we work very well together. So
there you go, Jim. Thanks for calling. Kathy in Hartford, your turn. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask, in the 1980s and 90s, I planted large numbers of different forms of blue spruce trees. And first I wanted to know how long should those live and what's going on. I see, besides my own property, I see a lot of other people where they're experiencing a lot of die-off on the lower limbs of the tree and actually going quite far up the stem, losing the lower branches. Yeah. And I was wondering what's happening.
Yeah, you, like everyone else, planted a lot of particularly Colorado blue spruce back in the 80s, and that's a very problematic species of spruce here in Wisconsin. They're native to the mountains in Colorado where the air is a lot drier, and when you get them into our environment, it's a little bit too wet, and there's a fungal disease that causes a needle cast, so the needles will drop off. It's called Rhizosphera needle cast. Again, we have a fact sheet on this at my website if you're interested in reading more. But the fungus gets in, oftentimes infecting when the new needles are just coming out, and then it'll kind of sit there until the needles age a bit. And once they're back in the inner canopy, then it'll cause, kind of activate and cause the needles to drop prematurely. And what you typically end up with are relatively bare branches with maybe a tuft of green needles at the tip. And as you mentioned, it works kind of from the bottom up the tree. Unfortunately, there's not much you can do because the fungus is everywhere. Usually trees are infected many, many years running, and you've lost all those needles. So the best thing you can hope for is to prune the branches up the tree, basically to give the tree a better look. If you were absolutely desperate, but again, I don't recommend this. I think it's, quite frankly, it's a waste of time and money. But if you caught the disease really, really early, or you had a single specimen tree that you wanted to protect, there are fungicide treatments, but you'd have to apply those every year and multiple applications. So it's not something that I recommend to homeowners. It's basically a situation where a particular type of tree, because everybody loved how it looked, it was overplanted. And so my recommendation nowadays is always diversify when you are planting a landscape. Don't crowd things too much. So plant all kinds of different trees, not all spruces, not all of anything. And then space the trees really far apart, and also do some judicious pruning in trees to open up the canopy to better airflow, because a lot of these fungal leaf diseases or needle diseases are more likely to be a problem if you've got dense foliage that traps a lot of moisture. So if the needles or leaves get wet, if they stay wet for a long period of time, leaf and needle diseases are more prevalent. So unfortunately, for the trees you have in place, there's not much you can do about them. It gets to the point again where it becomes an aesthetic question. Is the tree ugly enough that you don't like it anymore, at which point you should remove the tree and think about replacement with something else?
There we go.
Does it actually kill the tree, though?
No. No, what I always say is that it doesn't kill the tree, but it makes the tree so ugly that you wish they were dead. So, and it's not a lethal disease. There are actually other problems on Colorado blue spruce that can kill the tree, but not this particular needle disease.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you for calling. Gene in Fitchburg. Hi. Thank you for calling. Oops. Let me see here. Didn't quite get you. Now, Gene, are you there?
Yes.
Thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
Okay. We have a little cabin up in Door County in Egg Harbor on a very wooded lot.
Mm-hmm.
And the last two summers, something is coming off the trees that coats all the cars with like a very sticky sap.
No.
Turns the deck black, all the furniture outside black. and I'm wondering what is it and what can we do?
Yeah, we kind of talked, kind of skirted on this a little bit earlier with another caller, but what you probably are having a problem with is some sort of either aphids or scale insect in the trees in your little forested area. And what they're doing is they are producing what's called honeydew. It's basically their feces, and it's very loaded with sugars because they feed on sap. And when that falls on plant surfaces or on your cars, there are all these fungi in the environment that will colonize that because it's a great food source. And these fungi produce very darkly pigmented spores. And so what you need to do is figure out which insect you're dealing with and then how you manage those insects. Because if you can get rid of the insects, then you won't have a problem with this.
There might be something to spray the trees with.
Possibly. Sometimes that can be difficult, but there might be options for that as well. So the main thing to do is if you start seeing this again, look at the trees, the branches, the leaves of the trees over where you're seeing all this black growth and see if you see any signs of insects. And if you do, collect some branches that have the insects on them, and then you can send them in to our insect diagnostician and he can ID them for you and then provide recommendations on how you might control whatever you're seeing.
Okay.
All right. Good luck.
Thank you very much.
And you can do that through your county extension office. There's a county office in Door County or in Sturgeon Bay, and you can drop it off there, and then they can get it down to Madison for PJ to take a look at.
Yeah. There we go. Thank you so much, Joan. Vicki in Janesville, it's your turn. Hi, Vicki.
Yes. Good morning. I have one remaining old plum tree that was planted in 1954. Mm-hmm. Originally, we had three different varieties. This one, I believe, was what was called a plum or a fig plum. And the paper does say Italian plum tree, but they're like figs. The last couple of years, the fruit really does not grow. It stays very small and then wrinkles and gets hard and falls off.
Okay. Yeah, what I would do would be to check whether those kind of mummified fruits have kind of a buff sort of growth on them. Because, again, we had talked a little bit earlier about this brown rot disease, and that could be what you're dealing with. That particular pathogen can enter in during flowering, so you can get very early infections on the fruits right as they're developing. And the management, again, is to scour the trees and the ground around the trees for any of those little mummified fruits and get rid of them. And you may have to do this for several years. And then also watch for any branch dieback that you're seeing, the tips in particular, and prune those out down about 4 to 6 inches, because this fungus can infect branch tissue as well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there are fungicide sprays as well that you can get. So look for something that's labeled for brown rot of stone fruits. And usually the products that are out there that you can buy will list that disease on the label. And if you need recommendations, usually you do about 2 applications, one close to around flowering time and then one about 3 weeks before harvest, because you can get another round of infection around harvest time when the fruits are nice and succulent. So, again, we have a fact sheet on this on my website, if you would go there. Or for anyone who doesn't have web access, if you give me a call, I can send a copy of the fact sheet to you in the mail as well.
Thank you. May I have the number to call?
Yeah, 608-262-2863.
63. Okay. Now, when I try to pick up the fruit that falls, because it does, if I don't get them all and the squirrels plant them,
right,
I do get seedlings coming up.
Right.
Would those seedlings also be infected?
They might be infected. What you worry about more is once those fruits are buried, the fungus that's in the fruit will actually produce a little tiny mushroom-like structure, which produces spores that can reinfect the tree.
Okay.
So that's one of the reasons. So the squirrels are actually doing the fungus a favor, because those little mushrooms won't form if the fruits are on the surface of the ground. But once they're buried, then they tend to get stimulated to produce those.
Okay, and please give me the name of that disease again.
It's called brown rot.
Brown rot. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. Thank you, Brian. I appreciate
it. Yeah, no problem.
And Ron in La Crosse. Hi, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yeah, last week you had a gardening expert, and she recommended corn gluten as a organic pre-emergent. But I'm looking at a website here that says, well, maybe it'll prevent weeds from germinating or getting a root, and maybe it won't. One of them says these seeds might still, wheat seeds might still germinate, but they can't form a root and really take root. They also say that the timing of it, you need to water the corn gluten in maybe a quarter inch of water in your garden.
And so you're wondering, what do you think, Brian?
Yeah, unfortunately, I don't know anything on that particular subject. So I can't really comment on that particular question. Sorry about that.
Yeah, I wish we could help on that one. I'm not sure about it either, so I think we better let that one pass. Sorry, Ron.
Well, you might want to do, Ron, do you have an email? If you emailed me, what I can do is I can forward that email on to our weed specialist and get an opinion from him about whether or not that might work.
Mm-hmm. And what's your email address again?
It's Huddleson, HUDELSON at WISC, short for Wisconsin, .edu, short for education.
All right, there we go. We have someone on Facebook has a sedum roof garden that was invaded by spurge last year. She tries to get, what should she do? Would it be safe for the sedum and to take care of the spurge while she tries to get more sedum going to shade out the weeds?
Yeah, that would be another question for Mark, our weed specialist. So same comment as the previous person. If you want to email me with that question, I can forward that on to one of our weed experts.
Brian Huddleson, our guest. Brian is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic and the Department of Plant Pathology at the UW-Madison. Our guest on Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You are listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining in today. I'm Larry Mueller. My guest today, Brian Huddleson, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison. Always great to have him stop by. And thank you so much for listening. And if you have a question, maybe it's a disease question, I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We were talking about damping off earlier, Brian, and Eric on Facebook posted a picture of his pepper
very good
plants under grow lights. He's attached aluminum foil to reflect the lights, and next week we'll be transplanting them to larger pots. He learned about damping off from this show years back when he first started seeds. That's kind of cool.
That's very cool.
We had some other email questions here. Let's see if we can get to one or two of those. Let's see here. We've got Susan emailed to ask what the infection period is for bleeding canker on a horse chestnut as well as a Nectria?
Nectria canker. That's a common canker disease.
On a maple.
Yeah. The bleeding canker on horse chestnut, I'm not that familiar with. I'd actually have to go and read up on that particular disease because I don't see a lot of horse chestnut trees that come into my lab. But nectria canker is quite common, not only on maple, but a variety of other types of trees and shrubs as well. We oftentimes see that one come in through wounds. So if you're pruning the tree, definitely do it when it's dry.
Yeah.
We normally I recommend winter pruning for most pruning on trees, but there is actually some research in the literature that suggests for nectar canker, at least on honey locusts, that it may be better to do that in the summertime when it's hotter and drier. Tend to get fewer infections when you do it at that point in the year. I would just be very, very cautious whenever you're pruning to do it whenever it's dry. And for a lot of things, like I said, winter pruning is probably optimal. But definitely with nectar, it's one that cleaning your tools between cuts is very, very important, because that pathogen often takes advantage of wounds. And so if you've got contaminated tools, as you prune, you inoculate the tree.
Kathy in Green Bay has something for us. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I grow pretty successfully tall citrus trees. I have quite a variety. I have eight of them that I winter in a sunroom but place on my patio during the summer, and I am having an ongoing losing battle with scale.
Okay.
And I was just wondering if you had any recommendations for me.
Yeah, that's going to be a question I'm going to refer you to our insect diagnostician, because with scale, you really need to know exactly what kind of scale you're dealing with and kind of its life cycle, because there are particular periods during the life cycle of scale insects where they're very vulnerable to treatment. So it's when the little tiny scales are crawling about, and that can vary from scale insect to scale insect. So do you have a digital camera by any chance?
I do.
Yeah, I would take some photos, close-ups if you possibly can,
okay,
of the scale that you're seeing, and then email that to PJ Leash.
Okay.
And his email is pleash, P-L-I-E-S-C-H, at wisc.edu. If for some reason that doesn't work, you can always email it to me, and I'll forward it on to him.
Great. I appreciate it.
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Yeah.
You're
thanks
welcome.
So much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Ellen called to ask how come she doesn't see any black currants in Wisconsin.
It may be an issue. I'd have to look up hardiness for one thing on black currants, because I don't know if it's hardiness or not. But another reason why we tend to discourage growing currants is because there is a really serious disease on white pine called white pine blister rust.
Yep.
It's kind of like the cedar apple rust that we talked about earlier, except with this white pine blister rust, the fungus alternates between white pine and currants and gooseberries. And so you should not be growing those two hosts close to one another. And unfortunately, it's a lethal disease on white pine, particularly young pines. Once they become infected, the fungus oftentimes gets to the main trunk, and it will girdle the tree and kill it. So that may be part of the reason as well.
Andy in Cudahy, on to you now. Hi, Andy.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I also have a problem with fall raspberries. I have both the summer berry and the fall, and I find that the fall berries, depending upon the weather and when we have our first frost, I run into problems that before the frost kills the plant and it gets down to the lower or upper 30s, I develop on the ripening fruit of the fall berries a yellow coating, probably a fungus, I'm assuming, because of the moisture and everything. And I was just wondering if that is edible with that on there, or just throw them away, because I've tried one and it hasn't affected me.
Yeah.
The other thing I heard actually on this program years ago, that if you take your fall raspberries and cut them down to the ground in the spring, they will then develop earlier berries in the fall.
I can't comment on the cutting them down earlier. Larry may know something about that. What you're probably seeing on the fruit in the fall, though, is one of the rust diseases. There are some rust fungi and one in particular, and again, it's been a while since I've read up on raspberry rust, but there is one that specifically will get on the fruit. It will also get on the leaves, so I would check the leaves as well.
And only on the fruit, and it's a bright gold color.
Yeah, and the rust fungi, that's the reason they're called rust fungi, is because their sporulation is oftentimes very brightly colored. It can go all the way from yellow. In fact, there is something called yellow rust on raspberries, and that may be the one that you're dealing with. But that one, again, will, I believe, also goes to the leaves. It would be on the undersurface of the leaves. In terms of edibility, just because they're technically infected, my recommendation is usually don't eat those. It's not necessarily that the rust fungus is going to be a problem for you, but if they're in any way compromising the fruit and allowing in other sorts of organisms, there could be bacteria or other microorganisms that get into the fruit that might produce things that are not really great for us to be eating. So usually if we have blemished, adulterated fruit like that, my recommendation is not to eat them.
Right. Safest thing. The other question I had, do you have any problems growing lingonberries in our state?
I have not had a lot of experience with lingonberries. I think I've had exactly one sample of that come into my clinic over 20 years or so that I've been in the clinic. And so I think it is possible to grow them here. Actually, the person you might want to call, where are you located? You're
in Milwaukee County.
Milwaukee County. What you might want to do is give the Brown County UW Extension Office a call and talk to VJ Pandian. He's the hort agent up there.
Okay.
And he has been involved in growing a lot of specialty fruit crops up in that area. And he might be able to give you some insight. I think he has had some lingonberries up there, and he might be able to tell you what his success rate has been with them. The disease that I've seen on them has been powdery mildew. It causes a white kind of fuzzy growth on the leaves. So, and that's a disease that I've seen reference to on that particular host.
Mm-hmm.
But I think VJ would be possibly a resource for you. Again, if you go online and just type in Brown County UW Extension, you should be able to find a phone number for him.
Yeah, there we go. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. And Philothea in Viroqua, it's your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Right, thank you. You did pretty well with the name.
Good.
Hi, Brian and Larry.
Hi.
I have three questions. I grow hollyhocks, and I often save the seeds. And mm-hmm. my hollyhocks always get just the leaves just get just totally shredded during
okay.
the season. And I'm wondering, is that typical of hollyhocks, or is it a problem of saving old seed, or do I have some kind of
no, that's a hollyhocks tend to self-seed anyway, so that's yeah. a pretty natural way for them to maintain themselves. Do the leaves look really lacy? Is that what you mean by shredded?
So, yeah, you know, they look beat up, like they've been hit by hail or something.
Okay.
Like that.
I'm wondering whether you have an insect that's feeding on them, because mm-hmm. there are certain insects, it might be Japanese beetle, could be something else that will feed on the leaves, and they take out the tissue in between the veins
mm-hmm.
and leave the veins intact. Mm-hmm. That could be part of it.
Mm-hmm.
The main thing that I see on hollyhocks from a disease standpoint is rust.
Mm-hmm.
So if you flip those leaves over and look at the undersurface, if you see lots of little kind of brownish bumps
mm-hmm.
on the undersurface, then you're dealing with that disease.
Mm-hmm.
And that one will be carried over in little bits of leaf debris that you can't clean up in the fall from this year's hollyhock plants. Mm-hmm. So that's one that tends to recur year after year after year.
Oh, great. Well, it sounds like I might be what I have on my mint.
Okay.
On mint and lemon balm, the same thing happens. So the leaves will come up and they'll be really nice, and then they'll have these little brown spots on them.
Okay.
Is that rust?
I'd really have to look at mm-hmm. those leaves to tell you for certain. I'm sure there is a rust disease on mints, but again, it's not one I see that often. There are other foliar diseases that are fungal in nature that I do see occasionally on mints, but in order to tell you exactly what's going on and provide any sort of recommendation for control, I'd need to see a sample of that in the clinic, unfortunately. I'd have to look under the microscope and see what's there
okay.
in the tissue. Yeah.
And the third thing is I have this wonderful wild grape that's very prolific as far
right.
as leaves, and it would be nice to have growing over a trellis, and it,
mm-hmm.
and it grows near our house.
Okay.
But it develops these bumps on the leaves all the time. It never has any fruit. But it has these really ugly bumps on the leaves.
Yeah, I'm wondering if that's phylloxera gall, mm-hmm. which is an insect problem. Again,
mm-hmm.
do you have a digital camera?
Yes.
Yeah, if you take some pictures of that and send it to our insect diagnostician, I'm betting that if that's what that is, he can identify that very readily
okay.
from a photograph.
UW Insect Diagnostic Lab.
Right.
Okay.
All right. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. And let's turn to Madison and Don. Don, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I got a question about hawthorn trees.
Mm-hmm.
I live in Madison, and I don't remember ever seeing a single hawthorn tree.
Yeah, we have hawthorns in front of my building at the UW-Madison campus, and I mentioned them getting the spiny kind of salmon-colored fruit. If you ever want to see that, come down and visit me. I can show you that. Come in August or so, and we'll be able to show you that. Allen Centennial Garden has hawthorns
yeah.
as well. There are certainly quite a few as on campus, and so I'm sure there are hawthorns elsewhere in the city. They look very similar to crab apples, so sometimes people don't distinguish the difference between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay.
Yeah, and it's a pretty place to go. The Allen Centennial Gardens are wonderful.
Yes, indeed. And they're a block from my office, so if you want to visit them and then come over and see what I have going on at my clinic, we're about a block away.
You're in Russell Labs.
I am Russell Labs, corner of Babcock and Linden Drive.
And we, by the way, we have some open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Wallace in Weyerhaeuser, it's your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, due to circumstances beyond my control, there was a Mughal pine, you know, for decorative purposes. Now it has become large and, in my estimation, ugly.
Mm-hmm.
I am wondering how far it can be pruned, or should I attack it at the base with a chainsaw?
I would say basil pruning if it's ugly and it's too big, because you really can't prune those back other than right at the tips, because they will not produce additional branches if you prune them back really far on the branch. So if it's ungainly and ugly, then my suggestion is remove and replace it with something else, and make sure that you do some investigating before you buy the new shrub to check on maximum size, and assume that they've underestimated how big it's going to be. Oftentimes we see things with a particular size and they'll grow a little bit bigger. So get the right shrub for at the right size for your particular location.
Yeah.
Thank you much. You verified what I was thinking.
Yeah. I hate to say that for most, a lot of people, but sometimes that's the best course of
action. Sometimes that's the best way to do it. Well, again, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us as well at ideas@WPR.org, or post up on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Antoinette in Muskego has something for us. Hi, Antoinette.
Yes, hello. Good afternoon. I had a problem with some tomato plants that I planted in pots last summer.
Mm-hmm.
And some of them would come extremely healthy. The others would just have their leaves curl up real tight. And I was wondering, do they lack calcium? Do they lack any fertilizer? Water was no problem.
If you're seeing a lot of leaf distortion in tomato plants, I would look for a source of herbicides near the plants. So if they were near a lawn or a lot line where a neighbor may have a lawn care service, there may have been some drift. That's the most common reason why I see a lot of curling on tomato plants. A lot of these lawn care products contain what are called growth regulator herbicides, and they mimic plant growth hormones, and they cause a lot of really bizarre distorted growth. That's actually how they function to control weeds.
Yeah.
And tomatoes are incredibly sensitive to very low levels.
The other patch was, that was in the ground, not in pots. The other patch was Jew Mallow, and it also had, early on in the season, quite a bit of curling.
Mm-hmm.
And then the leaves started coming up quite normal.
Yeah, and that's pretty typical of an herbicide exposure, because it's only the leaves that are forming at the time of the exposure that will be distorted. Any subsequently produced foliage should look normal, unless there's another exposure of some kind. So I would investigate in your neighborhood about whether, or do you use any sort of weed and feed or spot treat with any sort of herbicide at all?
Yes, we are not actually. I'm trying to stay everything, biologically safe and all of that.
Sure.
And we have quite a bit of trees around our lot, so there's a barrier between us and the neighbors. But like you said, maybe on a windy day they sprayed and something just seeped up.
And
great, thank you so much.
Tomatoes are super sensitive. And the other thing to be aware of is if you're mulching with anything like straw or anything of that sort, you need to be very careful about the source of your straw, because sometimes that material has been produced in a field that was treated with one of these growth regulator herbicides, and there can be enough of a residue in that material to cause a problem. I had a colleague who had an issue with that this past year.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Lee in Green Bay, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thank you. Just a couple quick comment on when's the cutoff date now for pruning on our oaks.
Yeah, that one's really hard to comment on because the weather has been so variable. So quite frankly, at this point, if you're concerned at all but still need to do pruning, when you do the pruning, have a can of paint with you and immediately prune over the wounds. My normal recommendation is to prune oaks in the wintertime when it's cold. But we had that warm period in February where we got a pretty warm.
Yeah.
There might have been some insect activity at that point. So I am so paranoid about oak wilt that my recommendation is if you have to prune and you're at all concerned that the insects might be active that will move around the oak wilt fungus, paint over the wounds, and you have to do that immediately. There's research that indicates that sap beetles that can carry the oak wilt fungus can visit wounds on oak trees within about 10 minutes.
Okay, and then a question.
Mm-hmm.
I've got the tamarack, and then I have the black walnut. Black walnut's maybe 10, 12 feet tall. It's not a big tree yet.
Okay.
That's about 35 or 40 feet from a little stand of tamaracks I'm trying to get started. They're like 4 or 5 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
Are they, maybe in the future, but are they going to be affected with the roots? The black walnut?
I don't know specifically about tamarack. One thing I would check on, we do have a fact sheet called Black Walnut Toxicity. If you go to my website and check that out, on the back side of that fact sheet, there is a table with plants that we consider sensitive and tolerant to the toxins produced by black walnut. Now, you may find that tamarack doesn't show up on the list, which means either we couldn't find any information either way, or there are conflicting results. So if you can find it on there and it says that they're tolerant, I would say you're probably safe.
Yeah.
But if you don't find it on there, I would basically assume that you might have a problem later on. Just okay, worst case scenario.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Tom and Nina, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about oak wilt. Now, this is not red oak. This is bur oak.
Yeah.
And recently in Iowa, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago, it's been detected. It's been detected in Minnesota as well. How common is it in Wisconsin? And the reason I'm asking is that I have a bur oak that I planted some time ago in the backyard. I'm concerned about its health, so I'm just sort of inquiring about the propensity for it to pick up the disease.
Yeah, there are two diseases you need to worry about on bur oaks. There's true oak wilt, which it will get. That tends to be more of a severe disease on
reds.
Oaks in the red oak group, but yeah. It will go to oaks in the white oak group, which include bur oak. The other disease I think you're alluding to is something called bur oak blight, which is one
there
that was described at the University of Iowa, or Iowa State University,
and has been a
problem more in Iowa. I have diagnosed that here. The issue with that disease is that there are kind of two variants of bur oaks. There's, a smaller fruit and a larger fruit variety. It tends to be more of a problem with the variety that they have in Iowa, which I believe is the smaller fruited variety. It can go to bur oaks here in Wisconsin. Usually with that disease, even though it's been reported as being fatal on bur oaks, I usually, you know, because of the pathogen that's involved, I usually tell folks if I would diagnose that for you, I would look for other stressors on the tree, including things like two-line chestnut borer. There's some other diseases that I would look for because I know that you can kill seedling bur oaks by inoculating them, but killing off large mature bur oaks, I think, is a little bit more. I don't know that in my mind the evidence is there to show that that actually is what's going on. So
okay.
Tell folks, if you get a diagnosis of bur oak blight, definitely, and you have a lot of dieback, I would look for other things that might be involved in that dieback in addition to the bur oak blight fungus.
Okay, fine. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Ken in Duluth, Minnesota, hello.
Yeah, good afternoon. So I just had a couple of quick questions about apple trees.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a number on the property that I planted. And they seem to have gotten, or a handful of them have died now from some sort of a black scale. It looks like somebody took a blowtorch to the trunk of the tree.
Okay.
And initially I wasn't sure if it was more due to, you know, the wrapping that I had done, just to protect them from mice and moles over the winter.
Sure.
Because it seemed to start right above where the wrap was.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I unwrapped all my trees, but several of them have that black scorching had.
Okay.
Yeah. And again, that kind of goes back. We had a conversation with someone else about this a little earlier in the show. I don't think that black, charry sort of stuff that you're seeing is probably what's causing the decline and the death of your trees. I suspect that's just fungal growth that's coming in after the fact on trees that are a bit stressed. So there are probably other underlying problems in the trees and things that will kill off apple trees. Well, there's certainly fire blight, but that would kind of start in individual branches and work its way down towards the main trunk. Apples are also very susceptible to root rots as well, but you'd have to send in a sample for me to take a look at to know exactly what's going on.
Okay. And with that, I'm sorry, Ken, we are out of time, and boy, Brian, we've covered a lot. I hope you'll come back and be with us again.
Yeah, sure. A lot of great questions today. So whenever you want me, I will come back.
Brian Huddleston, our guest, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the Department of Plant Pathology in the UW-Madison. Great to have him, and he will be back. Liz Freemuth will be back with us next week on Garden Talk, and she will be talking about all things in the garden. In the meantime, hey, thanks for listening. Please stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network.